Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Idaho Governor Brad Little signs library censorship bill and signs pronoun bill, which opponents say will allow malicious misgendering. Coeur d'Alene teen accused of terrorist plot to murder gives his justification in jailhouse interview. Clarkston City Council considers how to deal with homeless lawsuit. We'll have details on those and other stories coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And you're tuned to KRFP Moscow Pullman and live in the KRFP studios. I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. 18-year-old Coeur d'Alene resident Alexander Mercurio pled not guilty in federal court this morning to providing material support to a designated foreign terrorist organization. The federal complaint says Mercurio communicated with terrorist supporters online and came up with a plan to hit his father with a metal pipe, take his guns, and attack nearby churches in Coeur d'Alene. The FBI says it had been tracking Mercurio for months and arrested him Saturday, the day before the planned attacks. The FBI also says Mercurio pledged his allegiance to ISIS. During an interview with the Spokesman Review at the Kootenai County Jail, Mercurio said he radicalized himself online after reading about Western countries who vote for politicians that interfere with predominantly Muslim countries and attack civilians. He said, "It's retribution. If our people will be slaughtered, it should happen to you." The paper reported Mercurio said he began to support groups such as Al-Qaeda, and he praised Osama bin Laden. He said two FBI agents approached him as he left his job at Walmart and told him they knew about his plan and arrested him. He said, "It's a consequence if I got caught. The point was to kill until I was killed." According to court documents, Mercurio wrote online in October 2022 about his conservative Christian parents, saying, "My parents want me to stop being Muslim and praying and drop everything 100% tomorrow, or they take away absolute everything and send me to in-person school to make sure I don't pray, or if that doesn't work, send me to youth camp or juvenile hall or something, I don't know. Please, I just don't know what to do. This will probably be my last message in a long time." Mercurio allegedly told an informant he considered killing his father, who was home all the time with a disability, but his family gave him less of a hard time because of good grades and he was keeping his religion to himself. The FBI says Mercurio began planning the attack in late March and announced his plans to kill people at a church near his house on April 1st. The FBI searched the Mercurio home on Saturday, and agents say they found a toolbox in Mercurio's closet with an Islamic State flag and weapons for an attack, including a machete. The FBI says Mercurio planned to steal his father's AR-15 rifle for the attack on Sunday. Idaho Governor Brad Little has signed House Bill 710, the bill that allows anyone from any state to petition to remove a book from a library if they deem it harmful to minors and receive money from a civil penalty plus uncapped court costs if the library does not move a book to an adults-only section within 60 days, or in the case of a school library that does not have an adult section, remove the book entirely. The Idaho House and Senate passed the bill despite overwhelming testimony against the bill during committee hearings. As the House debated the bill last month, Republican Representative Brent Crane of Nampa, who chairs the House State Affairs Committee, told lawmakers if the bill did not pass, he would revive a bill imposing criminal penalties and jail time against librarians if they distribute material that the law considers harmful. That was what the 2022 House Bill 666 would have done, but that did not pass. Governor Little vetoed a bill last year similar to the one he signed today, but this year's bill reduced the civil awards from $2,500 in last year's bill to $250 plus uncapped court costs. The bill defines harmful to minors based on the state's obscenity code, which prohibits writings about sexual conduct, and state law defines sexual conduct as, among other things, any act of homosexuality. The Idaho Library Association has published a list of books already challenged in Idaho, and many of them feature stories with LGBTQ characters or themes. House Bill 710 also specifies material that cannot be made available to minors include depictions of, quote, nudity, sexual conduct, or sadomasochistic abuse that, taken as a whole, is harmful to minors, unquote, or, quote, any other material harmful to minors. The civil enforcement mechanism of the bill was written by the extremist right-wing religious group, the Idaho Family Policy Center, which seeks to control what all people read, even people who don't belong to their religion. Idaho Family Policy Center President Blaine Consati said in February the civil liability language is, quote, the most effective way, unquote, to make sure the policy is enforced. The Idaho Press reports there is a video recording of Consati speaking to a Christian policy group called Capital Clarity in February, in which he said an earlier version of the bill, which also included the civil liability language, would inspire insurance companies to stop school districts from having controversial books. In a quote that implies insurance companies might overreach, Consati said, insurance companies don't want to pay out damages, they don't want to defend their clients, and so what they'll do is they will change their policies. The policies that the schools or the libraries are required to abide by if they're going to be insured by the carrier, and those policies are going to say, hey, you're going to have to remove these books. And here's what's going to happen. If a school or a library keeps making this material available to kids, they're going to lose their insurance coverage. Unless a court stays the law, it will take effect July 1st. Idaho Governor Brad Little signed the pronoun bill into law yesterday, which bars teachers from referring to a student by pronouns that do not align with the student's birth sex unless there is permission from a parent. House Bill 538 from Republican Representative Ted Hill of Eagle forces state schools to remove any requirements that teachers use preferred pronouns for transgender students and allows public employees to seek penalties if bosses sanction them for not using pronouns the law deems correct. The measure bars teachers from referring to a student by a name or pronoun that does not correspond with the student's birth sex, except when the teacher has the parent's consent. House Bill 538 also allows teachers to sue the school district if they are disciplined for refusing to use a transgender student's preferred name or pronoun. The new law takes effect July 1st. It impacts transgender students and public employees and others who identify as non-binary. The right-wing Christian nationalist group, the Idaho Family Policy Center, which drafted the bill, praised Governor Little for signing the measure that they say protects teachers from, quote, adverse employment action, unquote, and for using, quote, biologically correct pronouns. Idaho Family Policy Center President Blaine Consati said in a news release, even in school districts with no written compelled pronoun policy, educators feel pressure from administrators, parents, and students to use preferred pronouns. And these teachers rightly fear what might happen if they continue disregarding such demands. The American Civil Liberties Union of Idaho lobbied against the bill. The group argued the bill would permit teachers to persistently and intentionally misgender some students, which might be a violation of anti-discrimination laws. You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. For more information, visit loveskombucha.com.
Cowlitz County Superior Court Judge Gary Beshor has ruled Washington's ban on high-capacity gun magazines that are commonly used in mass shootings is unconstitutional. The state attorney general immediately appealed to the state Supreme Court and received an emergency order keeping the law on the books during appeal. Last year, Attorney General Bob Ferguson sued Kelso-based gun retailer Gator Custom Guns, which he said sold thousands of illegal assault rifle magazines. Gators challenged the constitutionality of the law as part of their defense. Judge Bashor sided with Gator's Custom Guns in a 55-page decision. He said the state law violates the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and a clause of the state constitution that grants people the right to bear arms for self-defense. The decision says there was no appetite to limit gun rights by the founders, though the specific technology available today may not have been envisioned. The founders expected technological advances. Many were inventors. Attorney General Bob Ferguson wrote in a statement, "Today's decision is incorrect. This law is constitutional. It is also essential to addressing mass shootings in our communities. This law saves lives, and I will continue to defend it." In Whitman County Superior Court yesterday, accused molester Juan Trejo Perez denied any wrongdoing in the case against him. Despite the testimony of several witnesses, Perez is being tried on charges of molesting a teenage Pullman boy in October 2023 after he arrived in Pullman from California the month before. Perez had been held in the Whitman County Jail for the past 6 months. The jail released him in February, but officials returned him to jail later that month. According to the Daily News, Whitman County Prosecutor Tessa Scholl said Perez exposed himself to the victim, touching him below the belt, asked about the victim's love life, and showed the minor pornography. Scholl said Perez was staying with the victim's family and was sleeping in the boy's bedroom during the visit. Scholl said in court that he fixed the lock on the bedroom door and gave the boy gifts such as an Apple Watch, a speaker, and a new phone. A witness testified one day prior to the incident, Perez asked a relative for a private room while visiting a home for a family birthday party so he could give the victim a massage. The person said she was uncomfortable about Perez giving the boy a massage and that she was better suited for that since she had previously been a certified nursing assistant. Perez declined her offer. According to testimony, during the night of the incident, Perez told the boy's mother he would watch over the boy so she could get some sleep. He reportedly asked the boy for a massage and attempted to molest him. The boy told the court he was shocked by what happened and told his family about it, who then reported the incident to police. Witnesses said the boy was happy before that, but after the incident, he was noticeably sad. One witness said he confronted Perez about what happened, and he acted defensive, and Perez hit him a few times to get him to stop. Perez allegedly told the witness he had to get to the airport the day after the episode so he could get back to his wife and family. Police found Perez at the Pullman Airport parking lot where they arrested him. Officers took possession of Perez's belongings, which included a backpack and a digital tablet. Sergeant Alex Gordon told the court it was apparent to him that Perez had facial injuries, but could not recall giving Perez any treatment. Pullman Police Detective Thomas Cornish testified he searched the tablet, which had no password protections, where he found pornography from the time when Perez was staying in Pullman. Public defender Steve Matonic told the court anyone could have accessed the tablet, and it was not determined who accessed the porn sites. Detective Sergeant Chris Engel said based on his training and witness testimony, Trejo Perez's behavior was consistent with grooming, which included allegedly asking the boy for a massage, conversations about sex, showing the boy pornography, and giving the boy gifts. Engel said fixing the lock on the door could help increase the time a person needs to get into a room. Trejo Perez took the stand where he said he gave the gifts to the alleged victim out of gratitude and to heighten the boy's self-esteem. He denied ever showing minors porn and said the tablet was his to use. Perez admitted to applying ointment to the boy's injury because family members would not do so and denied witness claims and said he never touched the boy inappropriately. Perez also said the boy was asking him about his love life and other questions that he wouldn't ask his father. The judge stopped Perez's lengthy testimony and adjourned court until this morning. The Clarkston City Council met in executive session Monday night to discuss a lawsuit filed by four homeless residents of Foster Park and the nonprofit Elves for the Homeless. The lawsuit was filed against the city. The four people living in Foster Park allege the city is violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. The four, John Park, Scott Darrington, Nancy Kasky, and Tamara Apfelback, filed the complaint in U.S. District Court for Eastern Washington Friday. The Lewiston Tribune reports the city council did not offer any comment on the litigation after the closed-door session. Clarkston allowed camping in Foster Park earlier this year after police closed a homeless camp with about 75 residents near Walmart after the city was informed that camp was on private land, not city land, as was previously assumed. Under the new city ordinance, those living at Foster Park must pack up their tents and leave with all their belongings by 7 a.m. each day, and they are only allowed to camp at the park between 9 p.m. and 7 a.m. The plaintiffs in the case say they requested changes to the ordinance in a letter March 7th, and the city failed to do so, constituting a failure to make reasonable accommodations. Northwest Justice Project attorney John Wolf told the Lewiston Tribune, "My clients are persons living with disabilities. They are residents of Clarkston, some of them longtime residents. This case is about asserting their rights to the basic means of survival." Wolf said police had cited at least 11 people for violating the ordinance. City Attorney Suzanne Hansen told the paper Friday, "None of those people are currently facing penalties, which could include up to 90 days in jail, a $1,000 fine, and a trespass order from the park for 6 months." Hansen said Friday the court had not yet served the complaint to the city, and she could not comment in depth except to say she was disappointed resources must be expended while the city waits for the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on Grants Pass versus Johnson, a case involving the Oregon city not allowing homeless people to camp on public land. Public comment at Monday night's city council meeting focused on the Foster Park issue. Cinnamon Stewart of Clarkston said the limited hours for camping makes it difficult for the homeless to pursue jobs because they must spend their days moving and protecting their belongings. Stewart said those living in the park are not all junkies and druggies, and some just wound up in that position. A woman said there has been hateful rhetoric on Facebook and people have threatened, stalked, and thrown fireworks at the homeless living in Foster Park. Jess Schroyer of Clarkston referenced personal attacks and accusations on social media. Schroyer told the council, "You guys are doing great. I appreciate all your work."
Access to Washington State's long-term care program will increase because of actions during this year's legislative session, but the program also faces a challenge on this year's ballot. Starting in 2026, Washingtonians will have access to up to $36,500 in benefits from the WA Cares Fund. A bill passed during this year's legislative session allows access to the program even if the contributor moves out of state. Home care aide Julie Sparkman says this was an important development for her adult children.
The portability of WA Cares is really important because you never know where you're going to go. The older you get, sometimes life takes you other places. And people should be free to do that. They shouldn't be stuck in a situation where it was the only way to access the benefits that they paid into.
Workers started automatically contributing a little more than 0.5% of their paychecks into the fund in July 2023. Initiative 2124 on the November ballot would allow workers to opt out of the program. Opponents of WA Cares say some of the people who pay the tax will never use the program's benefits. However, if too many workers opt out, it could crater the finances for the program. Advocates, including Sparkman, worry that if the initiative passes, it would effectively repeal WA Cares.
I'm really proud every time I see that on my paycheck stub. I'm happy with that because that is my participation in what I think socially needs to happen. And even if I never use it, I'm extremely happy to be a part of it.
In the past few years, Sparkman was diagnosed with breast cancer and had it treated. She says WA Cares might be important for her in the coming years.
Sometimes cancer comes back. So if I have a problem going forward, maybe the instability that that causes won't be as bad because WA Cares exists.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A new study in the journal Nature Communications by Montana researchers says suppressing small wildfires is leading to larger, more intense, and damaging blazes. The U.S. Forest Service says about 98% of wildfires are fully suppressed before they grow to 100 acres, most of them within 72 hours. In Montana, the latest data show crews kept 95% of wildfires to no more than 10 acres in 2022. University of Montana researcher and co-author of the new report, Mark Kreider, says this strategy leads to what's known as fire suppression bias.
Removing more of one type of fire than the other, what we're left with is biased towards these higher intensity fires, these more extreme fires.
Montana state policy calls for crews to extinguish fires as quickly as possible, even small ones. Kreider says researchers recommend letting low-intensity fires burn where possible to reduce the risk and damage for potential larger, hotter burning and more catastrophic blazes. Kreider acknowledges as the population grows along the urban-wildland interface, letting fires burn is not always possible, but argues it might be the best strategy for heading off catastrophic fires later.
Especially in the western U.S., where people live in, you know, close to forests, fire suppression is very important, and we still must do it. But this research helps to show when possible and in places when it's safe to do so, we really may benefit from allowing more low and moderate intensity fire to burn.
The National Interagency Fire Center says the number of acres scorched by wildfire has doubled since the 1980s, and the cost to battle the fires has risen to nearly $3 billion a year. I'm Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, mostly cloudy tonight, low 36, increasing clouds tomorrow, high 60, 30% chance of showers Thursday night, mainly after 2 a.m., mostly cloudy, low 43, 30% chance of showers Friday, mostly cloudy, high 60, 30% chance of showers before midnight.